Boop, beep, beep, boop. Catchy jingle? We need a catchy jingle.
Catchy jingle. This is the part where we put in the jingle. Snappy, snappy words and songs. Makes you want to buy these products. La, 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 la. I know what you're thinking, Kavi. I know what you're thinking.
What am I thinking?
I have earlobes with holes in them that I like to stuff little sparkly things into, like earrings. What you got for me now, Science Socks?
I mean, that's perfect because Science Socks has like the perfect things to shove in your tiny ear holes. They have James Webb Space Telescope tiny things that you can shove in your ear holes. They have Mars Lander things that you can shove in your ear holes. They even have, get this, they what? Even have space shuttle shaped bits of meteorite that you can shove in your ear holes. Tell me where else you're going to find that.
Head to toe, Science Socks has literally got you covered. It's fantastic.
It's wild. Although I wouldn't say head to toe. I would say head and toe. Nothing in between.
Well, they do have a really cool umbrella that looks like the parachute for the Perseverance of the rover, which you hold with your hand, which is middle-ish, but then it's over your head. Well, whatever. Go to sciencesocks.com/nerd, sciencesocks.com/nerd. And if you purchase anything from that URL, 10% of all proceeds go to STEM programs to help kids learn science.
Amazing. 10% of your purchase could be going to a STEM charity. Fantastic. I love it. Makes me happy.
All right, everyone. Hope you visit that shop. Enjoy, and many cozy footwearings to you.
You are listening to a Science Actually production.
We are federales, you know, the mountain police.
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Dancing into our 60th episode, if you can believe
it. Our 60th episode.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm so... Thanks.
And I'm so honored, actually. So for listeners, we have with us today a wonderful, wonderful guest, Tim Gagnon, who is the perfect person, I think, for our 60th episode, because Tim has been kind of part of my journey in the world of space and science communication for several years now. I think we first met in Cape Canaveral just after the launch of the Space IL Barry Shitlander. The launch, not the unfortunate hard landing.
Yeah. It made it.
it got there. That's the main thing. Yeah. but welcome to the show, Tim. It's so wonderful to have you here.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I look forward to speaking with you guys.
Ah, great.
Well, that.
This is, first of all, if anybody who has seen anything to do with astronauts going to space or space missions or any type of research project that, you know, research mission that NASA does or other agencies do, you'll see like a little logo or something that represents that crew or that team or that endeavor that they're trying to do. And Tim here is one of the guys who designs those emblems, those mission patches. And it's so cool. And when I was a kid, I would try to draw on a shirt, a little square next to a little circle with a line through it or something. Maybe a bit rudimentary compared to your work, but well, I was proud of it.
My original work was pretty rudimentary as well. So.
Well, thanks. But that's it. And everyone wants that cool jacket with the patches on their sleeve or whatnot. And I believe from what I've read, you got the inspiration to start this a long time ago on a fateful visit to the Kennedy Space Center. When was that?
This was when I was 16 years old. The Apollo program, of course, was ending. It was 1972. And I wrote to my senator in Connecticut, and I said, I need to see an Apollo launch. It was the Saturn V, for God's sakes. I had to see that beast fly. And nobody in my family, including myself, excuse me, expected that they would say anything other than thank you for your interest. But, but darn if they didn't say yes. So I was sent an invitation to the launch of Apollo 17 in December of that year. And then I had to write back and said, I'm 16. Can you invite my father? I can't rent a car. I can't rent a motel room. This is 1972. Teenagers didn't do that kind of stuff. You know, it would be years before I got a credit card. So they understood and invited my dad, and we had an amazing 3-day trip. And as you know, while it went up a little bit late, it did go up on December 7th, and it was as spectacular as you can just imagine.
There's nothing like a rocket launch, and I can't even imagine how the Saturn V compares to the launch that I saw of the SpaceX rocket. It must have vibrated through.
The closest thing I've seen since then, and all launches are spectacular when they go well, but the closest one I've seen to the Saturn V was the Space Launch System. And because it's essentially almost the same height, it's almost got the same liftoff thrust, the pounds. And it only difference was it jumped off the pad a little faster than the Saturn V did.
I love that. Jumped off the pad.
And so at what point did you realize that, obviously the fascination was there from an early age, but at what point did you start really diving into this as a hobby, and then eventually, it became formalized as something you were paid to do?
Well, during that trip, we were, of course, given briefings like guests are, and one of the briefings talked about the creation of the patch, and the 17 crew had asked Robert McCall to paint their mission patch, because that's how it was done in those days. And I'm sitting there in the audience, a brash 16-year-old who doesn't even know what he doesn't know. And I'm saying, I could do that.
Of course you can.
And so the following year, I started writing to astronauts saying, I would like to design your mission patch. Of course, all the Skylab missions by early 73 were designed, because they had to prepare them for clothing and all that kind of stuff, load the supplies into the orbital workshop before it launched. And so none of those missions were an option. But during the second increment, the RCS system on the Apollo Command Service Module developed a leak. And during the Skylab program, they always anticipated and prepared for a possible rescue mission, because they had the hardware in the flow, so they could repurpose a Saturn 1B and the Apollo spacecraft to launch two guys to go get whatever Skylab crew was in trouble. Mm-hmm. So they chose Vance Brand and Don Lynn to fly that rescue mission. And I wrote to Vance Brand asking, I heard you've been assigned to this mission. Here is a design that I drew for your Skylab rescue patch. And he thanked me for it. He sent me a note saying that because it took him a few weeks to respond. They were kind of busy. And he said, as when he responded, it looks like we won't need to fly the mission. And because they did develop a workaround where they could isolate those thrusters, and the second crew was Alan Bean's crew, they did return home on time, safely, as we all know. Well, fast forward to 2017, and I'm at Space Fest in Tucson, and I meet Vance Brand and his wife, and I said, sir, you have no reason to remember this. Obviously, it's been 44 years. But in 1973, I wrote to you and I sent you artwork for a Skylab rescue patch. His wife spoke up and says, I know exactly where that is. They had he had saved it for almost 50 years. And he sent it back to me that fall. And it happened to arrive on my birthday in the mail. So it was,
oh my gosh,
especially. And I hadn't seen that drawing in 44 years. And it, I mean, it's nothing impressive. It's done with Crayola crayon, and you know, and I always hated printing the letters on the patch because you have to be so neat. And, you know, nowadays, you know, you can type it in on a keyboard and insert it, and you know, so that's very seductive and very easy in comparison. But mm-hmm. it was something to see that artwork again after so much time.
Wow.
And he said, you know, I just wish I could have flown it for you. Yeah. I said to myself, yeah, me too.
You've had quite a few patches and emblems flown. How many have gone up or been the official logo of the team? The
first one was in 2004. And John Phillips, who was a flight engineer assigned to Expedition 11, responded to my inquiry saying, sure, we'd love to work with you. And we ended up working over the summer and fall of 2004. The patch was unveiled, I believe, in early 2005 at their pre-flight press conference. And when it was unveiled, I got an email from Dr. Jorge Cartes from Madrid, who was now retired, but he was an orthopedic surgeon. And he said, you know, congratulations on your accomplishment. You know, I too have always dreamed about designing a mission patch. And honestly, I had no idea if we would ever get another opportunity. I mean, you know, every artist wants to do something like that. And it's an abundance of riches for astronauts. They can pick and choose anybody they want. And I said, but if we do ever get another opportunity, you and I can collaborate. So everything from STS-126 that we worked on in 2008, I flew in 2009. Everything since then, we did 5 shuttle missions and 14 more space station missions.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it was a dream that was realized in 2004, and I never expected that they would continue to say yes, and I would continue to have such a wonderful opportunity.
I can.
It's an abundance, and I'll be forever grateful.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Right. Like after 30 years, basically, of continuing to show interest and to send letters and to do designs, when one gets picked up, you're probably thinking to yourself, "Okay, I'm going to make the most of this opportunity. It's going to be a one and done sort of thing."
Absolutely.
And. And they must have liked it. You must have done a great job.
Yeah. Well, what I learned very quickly was to remove my ego from the entire process, because I'm just the lucky guy that gets to work with some very impressive people. It's their patch. So they have to have the sense of ownership, and it's their surnames on the patch. So, you know, by remembering that and not pushing my narrative, saying, no, you're wrong, this is what it has to look like, then successive crews recommended me to other crews. So, you know, the 126 crew recommended me to the 127 crew, to the 129 crew, and so on and so forth. And that was especially gratifying.
When is there like an official announcement by NASA or by the next crew that, right, we need a new patch? Is there some sort of like a contest amongst, you know, potential designers out there? They all send out their ideas.
I'm sure they are. I'm sure crews receive unsolicited ideas all the time. And as the shuttle program was ending, the 132 crew, affectionately nicknamed the first last flight of Atlantis, was given a lot of interest as well. And they turned it into somewhat of a contest of family and friends and people who had submitted ideas. Well, I got an email from Garrett Reisman, who was a mission specialist on that flight, received it, I believe it was Halloween in 2010, that Jorge and I had were co-winners with another team of two people because we had submitted similar designs that showed Atlantis flying into the sunset. And of course, like Garrett said, we fly west to east, so we're actually flying into the sunrise, but artistically it resembles that. And and so we were named co-winners, and you know what, we got to participate, and they gave us appropriate credit, so we can proudly claim co-ownership of that design. And of course, the graphics team at Johnson Space Center took both of the team's artwork that were not completed, polished, finished work, and they kind of combined it with Garrett, because he was the patch guy for that flight. And they came up with essentially a simplified version of what we had submitted.
I'm looking at that patch now, and I think what's kind of interesting to me is that all of the patches, by necessity, right, will contain similar features.
Oh, yeah.
But they're all so unique. When you just look over, you know, I'm looking at a webpage, on your webpage, I should say, with, you know, over 500 emblems. And even though they have similar themes, they're all visually unique and different to one another.
That is the challenge, because every crew, you know, you have to start out with what is their mission? What makes their mission different from any previous mission or any subsequent mission? And you try to illustrate that story in that small canvas. And every crew wants something unique. I mean, it's understandable. You know, there was talk early in the space shuttle program of not letting crews have a patch. They were just going to have the shuttle program emblem, that triangle shield, and the little tab underneath it with the name of the orbiter. And that was going to be it. And the astronaut office said, no, we're flying these missions. You know, some of these guys in the early shuttle program waited 19 years to fly. They wanted to see their name on a patch. And sure. Who can blame them?
For sure. I'm sorry, go on, Kavi.
No, go on.
Sorry. I was going to ask, when you're receiving all the input from the astronauts or, you know, what they'd like to see on the patch, has there ever been something they've requested that's just, you know, either you or maybe NASA deemed maybe inappropriate, or we can't put that there? Like, any jokesters out there want a turkey on there? Something funny?
nothing inappropriate, you know, because they had learned by that time, don't try to slip something in, because the people that review that artwork, they know what to look for. You know, they'll recognize, you know, any suspicious constellations or whatever. But there have been rough sketches from shuttle crews that, you know, and our job is to illustrate what their idea is. They have to decide on themselves, oh yeah, this is not going to work as well as we thought it might. So, you know, there are things like that where they will suggest something, but, you know, these are scientists and pilots and, you know, and engineers. They're not necessarily artists, although there are a few artists sprinkled throughout the astronaut corps. And so they need to have their idea illustrated, and then they can decide, oh yeah, that's not really going to work. So what we do is we research the mission ourselves and come up with designs of our idea telling their story. And they will pick and choose, oh yeah, we like that, but don't take that other thing out of there and let's try something else. And eventually, over the course of the process, we get from rough sketch, rough draft to final art, sometimes in just a few weeks. I think the longest one took about 11 months, because the crew was very diligent about making sure everybody got to weigh in. But, you know, there are times that we wouldn't hear from them for a couple of weeks because they were off training in other parts of the world, you know, and they had other things to do. And the patch kind of just sat on the shelf until they were ready to look it over.
I think what's really cool about these patches, and it kind of reminds me of a conversation that I had, this fireside chat we did with Garrett Reisman, actually. Mm. He raised a really interesting point at the time about how his generation of astronauts, as opposed to the Apollo generation, were striving to be more accessible, more human, less on a pedestal, to make space accessible. And I think that the patches definitely do a great job of doing that. It's something that people can really reach out and connect to.
Sure.
It's also kind of a perfect segue into an ad break that we're going to do very, very quickly. Okay. Just to mention that today's episode and this whole season has been brought to you by Science Socks. Whether you're into Mars rovers, James Webb Space Telescopes, or just showing off your love for all things nerdy, Science Socks has just the right stuff to add a dash of galactic flair to your life. For folks who are listening, you can go to sciencesocks.com/nerd. That's sciencesocks.com/nerd for all the perfect wearables for scientists, engineers, nerds, and geeks. Science Socks, the only place in the galaxy for geeky socks and astronomical jewelry.
Love Science Socks. And you mentioned the James Webb Space Telescope. You made the James Webb patch.
Well, I made a James Webb patch. It was a commemorative. The official
commemorative one
is also available from AB Emblem. But Jorge and I started on that thing probably a little over a year before it actually launched. Because, of course, we knew this was going to be something game-changing. If this thing was successful, just with the size of the primary mirror, it was going to be so much of an improvement over what Hubble could do with its mirror. And I think Hubble's was like, I don't know, 84 inches in diameter, and we're talking feet now. And so we had a design in mind, and we contacted AB Emblem, and of course they were interested. They wanted to see the final art, and then the launch kept getting delayed. I mean, it was a engineering marvel to not only build this thing, test it, but ship it to South America so it could be put into a rocket and launched. And it was just a perfect storm. I mean, they got it down there. It launched, I think it was, what, Christmas Eve or Christmas morning? And the patches were available. AB Emblem was ready. So they released the patch on their website on Christmas Eve. And, I mean, it's the holiday. It's good news. It was a successful launch, successful deploy. And those things were, you know, gone in a matter of hours. I don't know how many reruns they've done of the patch, but it was, I wish that story could be true of every one of our patches, because it was just a really neat story for Christmas of, I think it was 2021.
Awesome.
You kind of forget, right, about the, there was that period when people were joking that it should be called the Just Wait Space Telescope because of these delays.
Sure.
But but it's kind of a good thing that they did, because the data, just putting my astronomer hat on for a second, the data that we've been getting, both the images and the spectroscopy, has been phenomenal. So if they needed to wait a little bit to make sure that, you know, everything would be safe and there'd be no damaging vibrations, totally worth it.
Absolutely. And unlike Hubble, it can't be serviced. I mean, it's in an orbit that's unreachable as of yet. Who knows what's going to happen in 10, 20 years. I mean, somebody could develop a spacecraft that could get out there. But, you know, how do you latch on to that thing, and how do you fix it? So hopefully it never becomes necessary. But that's why the pre-launch preps had to be so diligent. And, you know, if that moves the needle to the right, the launch date, then it does it. But, you know, God forbid that thing launched and either the, you know, the vehicle, the launch vehicle had a failure or, you know, the deploy didn't happen properly. I mean, there's a lot of sad people all over the world. So, you know, it was it was a wonderful story of an engineering miracle to me.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Every time now that they're sorry, I'm just nerding out about James.
nerd.
Like the you know, there was all this press recently about the biosignature, potential biosignature that was detected with James Webb, and like perhaps on a technical level, I don't necessarily think that it was the, you know, nail in the coffin. We've definitely seen signs of life on an exoplanet, but we are measuring the chemical composition of an atmosphere on a different planet in a different solar system. And that's just
mind-boggling.
Yeah. sorry, Benjamin. I know you have plenty of questions prepared. But that's
No. I love watching you geek out. It's great. That's what we're all three of us are doing.
I mean, we are inherently curious. So the fact that we can build something and have it study something so far away and get that data, I mean, that's amazing.
Yep.
That's amazing. Have any of your patches ever been flown and then handed back to you by someone who brought it to space?
All of the mission patches have been flown, and I've got a wall full of them, and my grandsons like looking at that display, and I'm sure there'll be some discussion. I'm like, I want that one. No, I want that one. You can have that one. But you know what? That won't be my problem. I told them they'll just have to split them up as fairly as they can.
How big is your collection? I mean, do you have one of every single mission or just the ones you did
One flown one of every single mission. And then, of course, I've got two complete sets. With all the patches I've worked on, I try to curate two complete sets so that each grandson will have, you know, a box of, well, 500 patches. And I said, now, there's going to be some that mean more to you than others. Like my first grandson was at the launch of STS-126. He doesn't remember it because he was just a little over a year old. But I said, you know, we've got pictures. You were there. And he met the commander, Chris Ferguson, the following year, and Chris handed him a patch, took it out of a pocket on his flight suit, and that's framed with a picture of me holding my grandson. Obviously 126 will probably go to him, that flown patch. But you know, all these displays, all these flown patches are just mementos of the opportunity to work with these people. You know, the patches are great and I really appreciate the reaction they've received. But the fact that I got to spend all that time working with crews on their patch, and now that patch becomes the symbol for that mission forever.
Oh yeah.
You know, my great, great, great grandchildren, if they have to research what shuttle mission launched in the fall of 2009, and they'll look up STS-126 and they'll see artwork that I created or I helped create. You know, maybe make this clear. No patch has a single parent. It's a team effort. Jorge and I work together as artists, but the astronauts own that thing just as much as anybody.
Absolutely.
Because it represents their wishes for what the patch should look like. So
it's really
just a very lucky guy that gets to work with them.
I love that. Cause I feel like you're really echoing what you said earlier about removing your ego from the design of the patches. And as beautiful of an idea as it is to have this sense of continuity with the existence of the patches and your grandchildren and great grandchildren being able to see your connection to these missions. I'd never actually stopped to think about that. The main thing that you get out of it is this connection to the space industry, to the astronauts, to this thing that you have, you know, for 50 years had such a passion about. Sure. And you get to be involved in it. You get to work with these astronauts. And it's that experience that really is the main thing to cherish. It's really beautiful.
Now, one of the nicest offshoots from this experience was that astronauts that I admired as a child, I've gotten to work with them. I got to work with Scott Carpenter on the 50th anniversary patch for his Mercury flight. Aww. And you know, he called me up and he consulted. I mean, I was like 6 years old when he flew. And the idea that, you know, I get a phone call from Scott Carpenter and we discuss the design. And then he recommended me to Walt Cunningham, who was the LEM pilot for Apollo 7. And Walt and I worked on two projects, the modern replicas of some of these old mission patches have kind of suffered like being a copy of a copy of a copy. So The beauty of the original artwork has kind of been lost. I mean, look, if you have to, the clearest example of this is look at a vintage 1970 Apollo 13 patch and what the horses look like on that patch. Look at the modern replica of that patch, and it's just not as pretty. It's just not as powerful looking. And, you know, the type of embroidery machines change, and maybe part of that is the fact that they didn't want a modern replica to be confused with a vintage patch, because there's different values. People will pay more for a vintage than a modern one. So, you know, but Walt and I both agreed that the Apollo 7 patch was especially frustrating to him because they had the angle of the spaceship wrong and it was too big. The original Apollo 7 patch that they wore was just under 4 inches. So it was smaller than the typical mission patch. So back, I want to say it was around the 2008 timeframe, he and I worked on creating a limited edition series with his initials ghost stitched into the patch of an Apollo 7 replica that he offered on his website. And it was very well received. And, people just ate him up. And of course, he offered certificates with his signature and all that kind of stuff. And that was very cool for me, you know, working with Walt on that. And we became friends over the years. And then a few years later, over discussions, I learned that they had wanted, Apollo 7 had wanted the call sign Phoenix for their mission. And it was, you know, poo-pooed by NASA because, you know, Phoenix rising from the ashes of Apollo 1 was deemed in poor taste. And I understand their reason for wanting that call sign. And I can appreciate NASA managers being a little gun shy with spacecraft names. They never got to have that call sign. And the spacecraft was always known as Apollo 7. Well, we did a Phoenix themed Apollo 7 patch, I want to say around 2013, and he offered that on his website. And, you know, his widow may still have a few in a box somewhere. I don't know. It wasn't as widely received as the original replica that we worked on, but it satisfied him. And that was awesome, you know, that we got to work on something that he had wanted since he first flew. And then, of course, if you've ever seen pictures of Charlie Duke in his flight jacket, he's got my 12-inch Apollo patch on the back of his jacket. Now, to have a moonwalker wearing my art, I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Well, that's the top.
Yeah, that's is Jerry on the Sunday. I mean, okay, Mike, drop the mic. I'm done. Thank you very much. You know.
Yeah, there's been a lot of astronauts. There's only been like 14 that went onto the moon.
Yeah.
And one of those guys.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, he liked that patch so much, he has been wearing it for like almost 20 years now.
So I think I'm curious, at a certain point you became an analog astronaut yourself.
Yeah, you got your own name on a patch now.
Yeah, last year, because over the last 10 years, I've supported the Mars Society, and I've worked with analog crews on their mission patches. And I believe, Ben, when I sent you that PowerPoint, there's a slide in there of all the analog patches, so you can reference that when you're ready. But because of that support, they invited me to join a crew as an embedded artist. And I finally, after how long, got to design a mission patch with my name on it.
Yep. Beautiful. Oh, it's big. Beautiful.
So for folks who are just listening, there's a beautiful patch with a phoenix artwork where the feathers kind of merge into an American flag. And then you have this Martian landscape with a habitat. Yeah. For people who are only listening, you have to check out the video for this episode to see that.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, the Mars Society has posted it on their social media, so it's available to see. But I mean, and we worked on that patch the same way we worked with any crew. We had a team meeting. We chose the name Phoenix first, and then we came up with the design. And this went through many iterations. And I decided, instead of having the Phoenix rising from the surface, to have it landing. So if you look at that Phoenix analog mission patch and the Apollo 11 patch, because I'm a child of Apollo. You look at Apollo 11, that shows the Eagle landing on the moon, you can see a resemblance there. And that was deliberate, because both the mission commander on this analog mission and me, we remember Apollo 11. We were alive when it happened, and so we saw it in real time. Of course, we saw it on a little black and white TV, but we still saw it.
Still.
Yeah.
So as the embedded artist on that analog mission, what exactly did you do?
Well, actually, most of my work has been post-mission, because what we did do during the mission is I had prepared images, paintings and sketches, like the sketch of Paul Kelly getting suited up, because sketch of Neil Armstrong getting suited up by Paul Kelly, because he was the only artist allowed to join the Apollo 11 crew on launch day. And amazing pen and ink sketch. And I'm friends with his son, Chris, and he's shown me the original sketchbook. I mean, the fact that he could do something that good with a fountain pen in real time, because Neil wasn't posing for this. He had to sketch like really fast, and he did it. I mean, it was amazing. So using things like that, and then paintings by Alan Bean. So we used some of that for inspiration, and we took photos during the mission of representing that artwork. So that's what we could do during the mission in real time. And I posted it on my social media, Instagram and so forth. And but the work that I'm doing now is preparing more polished artwork that I'll donate to the Mars Society in the hopes that they can use it for their fundraising activities.
Ah, I was following along your social media posts when you were at that mission. I saw you taking photos of your boot print.
Just got all kinds of giddy. I mean, if Buzz Aldrin could do it, so could I, you know?
where was that mission, and how long was it for?
Utah, right? It was in southern Utah. It's a little town called Hanksville. And I tell you, when we first drove up there and I first saw the campus for the first time, I understand why the site selection committee chose it, because it looked like a Martian landscape. I mean, the dirt is reddish, and I mean, it was perfect. And because of the remoteness and the fact that we only had a calm window for a short time each day, you could accept during the simulation that, yes, you are not at home anymore. You're not going to go run down to the store and grab something. You are in a spacecraft on the surface of Mars, and you accept that, and you work the mission plan. Now, because most of my work is taking place post-mission, during the mission, I supported my crewmates. I mean, I cleaned, I cooked, and did all those things so that they could focus on their experiments that they were had planned on doing. And it was a 2-week simulation.
Wow. It's a long time to be stuck in the Utah desert with a bunch of people.
Yeah. Well, the good news is,
put a helmet on.
We had started meeting over Zoom, God, almost a year before we went to Utah. So we kind of had a sense of each other's, you know, sense of humor and you know, the kind of people we were going to be living with for 2 weeks. So it worked out really well.
Sure. Oh, that's cool. So, Benjamin, when are you doing your analog mission?
I'll see it tomorrow. My calendar's pretty open, so I'll go next one. I'll do the next one happily. I'll do just that. I will support the crew and I will cook for them. They're not going to eat well, but I will cook for them.
Well, just familiarize yourself with freeze dried stuff, and.
That I could do.
Yeah, well, my last experience with freeze dried food was when I was in scouting 50 plus years ago. It has improved since then. So
I'll tell my kids he's in scouting.
Ate pretty well.
They eat like kings.
We'll have to.
I have a fun question.
Sure.
Okay. Maybe a little self-serving, but the logo for our show is a rubber duck because we're serious. And it has its own ring system going around it, like Saturn, because we're science lovers. And whenever we have guests on our show, we add an astronaut riding the duck, which I already have ready for you.
Okay.
And Cobby's Australian and I'm an American. Mm. Off the top of your head, what's the mission patch for this show going to look like?
Well, if you go to my website and you look up the Sigma 7 50th anniversary patch, my initial first thought, based on your description alone, would be something like that, except replace the turtle with a duck.
That's it. I'm going to
look
it up.
Wally Schirra's family particularly like the fact that I had a turtle orbiting the Earth for that patch. Because Wally's famous question, are you a turtle?
Oh, my God. Okay. All right. See? Everyone thinks it's turtles all the way down, but it's not. Turtles going around.
Exactly. Mm.
they were so close.
That's just, you know, based on your description, that's just my first thought of what I would create for the show.
All right. You know what? I'm going to try. I'll mock it up and I will send it to you for your approval.
Okay.
I love it. All right. I think now is probably a good time to start our rapid fire round of questions and quibbles.
Okay. Yes, let's do it.
Are you ready for this, Tip?
Maybe I should put on my seatbelt to get ready for this. It's like when Star Trek has to put on the shields when they're getting bombarded. Go ahead.
Yeah. All right. So first question, what is the weirdest thing that you believed as a kid?
Oh, weirdest thing. Well, I was 7 years old when John F. Kennedy was killed. And I kind of bought into some of those conspiracy theories as a kid. But luckily, I met some FBI agents, became friends with them, and I got a personal tour of Dealey Plaza. So some of those wilder parts of the conspiracy, I don't accept anymore. Although, you know, I think he was targeted by more than just one crazy with a gun.
Okay. Which teacher had the biggest positive impact on you?
Well, this one's going to be a little bit different than any answer you probably expect. But, excuse me. When I was 6 years old, my mother walked me to elementary school for the first day of first grade. And I met my teacher, Miss Landgrebe. And to me, she was like Grace Kelly and Marilyn Monroe put together. And I was just in awe. I was madly in love with her. And 4 years later, she broke my heart when she went off and got married. She didn't wait.
Marvelous.
But, oh, yeah. I mean, she was stunning. To a six-year-old boy, I mean, yeah. I mean, I've had some good teachers since then, but I will always remember Miss Landgrebe.
That is certainly the most unique answer I think we've gotten to that.
There you go. Well, we got to do something special for the 60th episode, you know?
Absolutely. Miss Landgrebe. You broke a poor boy's heart, listening.
Yeah. I eventually survived, and I married a beautiful blonde, so I, you know, it's okay.
Hey, me too.
And you've had, what, 47 years of beautiful marriage since
so
then.
Far.
Right?
So far.
There you go. What is one scientific discovery that you wish you could have witnessed in person?
Well, like if I was there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I would have liked to have been on the moon when a landing happened, you know, obviously from a distance, but I would have liked to have been like the third crewmate there and actually see it happen. I mean, I was in awe of the early space program, but actually seeing these guys walking on the moon, which I entirely believe happened. It happened six times. I don't engage with flat earthers or moon deniers or anything like that, because if it was fake, our adversaries would have called us out on it immediately. So yeah, I would have liked to have been there on the moon and witnessed a landing.
Excellent.
Nice.
If you had to pick one historical scientist to go bowling with, who would it be?
Bowling. Well, I don't know how good any of the scientists bowl, but I wouldn't mind knocking a few pins down with Robert Goddard. I think that would have been an interesting experience.
Nice.
I feel like he probably has like a really unorthodox bowling style that's also really effective.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, however they do it, I'm sure it's effective.
All right, so we're starting into the more serious questions of the rapid fire round. Okay. Tim, if you were a sandwich, what kind of sandwich would you be?
Well, I grew up in New England, so it would be a grinder, which is the proper name for a sub or a hoagie, and probably an Italian.
Nice.
Yeah. I like the spicy food.
Nice. Okay, well, coming from New England, second you probably have a good answer for the next one.
Second choice would be a pastrami in New York City.
Pastrami. Oh my gosh, yes.
Oh yeah. I mean, I didn't build this body overnight, guys. I mean, I worked at it a long time.
It's a commitment. What is your most controversial opinion about pizza?
No pineapple. I've had it. I'm sure you know, it has its, you know, people that enjoy it, and that's fine. I'm not going to kick them out of my house because they decided to have pineapple and ham pizza for dinner, but I'm not going to choose to have that.
You're breaking my heart, Tim, but I'm glad that the standing invitation to your house is still open. All right, what would you say is your favorite scientific word or phrase?
Oh, that one I'm not sure. because I'm an artist. I don't use a lot of scientific words or phrases.
Or perhaps something tied to the space industry, particularly favorite word or phrase.
Max Q.
Max Q. Max Q.
I too have a Zazzle store, Tim, and I have a t-shirt that says Max Q across
there
the chest,
go.
And I love that phrase.
And Max Q, if I'm not mistaken, is the point during the launch at which the launch vehicle undergoes the maximum dynamic pressure.
Dynamic pressure, yep.
That's why they throttle down the engines so that they don't crush the vehicle.
Mm.
It's ridiculous. Cool. I love it.
Nice. Yeah, good phrase.
What is your least favorite scientific or space industry related word?
Anything to do with bean counters saying something is not worth it. Give the engineers a mission, let them design it, and then give them the money to execute it. When they have to make compromises just based on economics, I'm not a fan.
It'd be something like not fiscally viable or something like some phrase like that.
Let the discovering people go discover something. You just
if they have been given a mission, let them complete the mission. Come on.
Yeah. The only thing the finance people should be saying is make it so. Just
that's good. Yeah. Just sign the damn check. Now, let them do their job and make sure we're not paying, $300 for a screw. But, let them do their job.
For sure. Next question. What is your favorite useless fact about science or space?
Wow, useless fact. I would say that Mars gravity, surface gravity, is 1/3 that of Earth. I mean, I'm never going to go there, so it's useless to me. But I wouldn't mind weighing 1/3 of what I do.
Same.
But then all of that hard work with the pastrami sandwiches, I mean, it goes to waste.
Work even harder.
Pastrami weighs 1/3 less on Mars, so,
And tastes twice as good there, too.
That's right.
So we have to go try it out.
That's right.
If you could rename one planet in our solar system, what would you call it?
Well, I would get rid of Uranus because... I've got two grandsons, so I've already had to relive Uranus from when I was a kid again. So, I would dump Uranus and, I don't know, maybe call it Vulcan or something.
Ooh.
I like that.
Got that one.
I wouldn't call it Alderaan because they blew Alderaan up. So. No sense putting a target on the thing,
Yeah. Make one of Mars's moons Alderaan, because those are going to blow up.
Well, those Mars's moons have the Greek names for, it's kind of like pain and panic, right? Phobos and Deimos, right?
Yeah, Phobos and Deimos, yeah.
All right, so Tim, you mentioned earlier, reaching the pinnacle of your career, feeling like you could just drop the mic. But if you had to pick the mic back up and sing one karaoke song to save humanity from an alien invasion, what would that song be?
Well, maybe my singing would deter aliens. Who knows? But Fly Me to the Moon. It's one of my favorite Frank Sinatra songs. So
that's a solid answer.
That's a great song. My little kid is picking up on my very eclectic music taste, and she discovered Frank Sinatra, and she loves that song.
This isn't we've finished the rapid fire rounds, and you did great. You pulled through. But as a side question, as a follow on, I'm curious: What did you think of the movie, the recent movie, Fly Me to the Moon?
It was okay. I mean, you had to go into it understanding that this was, you know, a rom-com. So it was not meant to be a serious documentary, you know. So, and, you know, you have to explain to some of those that embrace line of thought that if we had wanted to fake the moon landing in 1969, we couldn't. You know, the technology just didn't exist to fake it. So, you know, we didn't fake it, but, you know, I would go see, you know, a movie that is designed to be, you know, something of a feel-good comedy. Yeah. And, you know, just accept it.
Not a documentary.
Yeah. Just go into it understanding.
Mockumentary.
Yes. That it's a fun movie and not a news special. But I thought they treated the whole possibility well.
Hmm.
You know, the way they presented it.
I only watched the opening of it, and I really liked it. And I never finished it. Now I'm going to go finish it tonight. Actually, I'll start over. It's been a bit. But I like how it started off. Just improbable.
Well, you know, I would watch Scarlett Johansson read the phone book. I don't care.
Okay. Well, phone books are smaller if they exist at all these days. So that's
I'm sure she could hold my so interest.
I'm sure she'd make it work. I'm sure she would make it work. I think that wraps up the episode. Absolutely. The Big 6-0.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Tim. I can't thank you enough.
Thank you so much. Invitation. Yeah. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Ah. And for all the people listening, where can people find you online and see your 500 plus patches and emblems and everything else you do?
Well, my website is www.kscartist.com. And my social media handles are also KSCartist, Instagram, Facebook, and so on.
Wonderful. Thank you. And you, Kavi?
Yeah, folks can find me on all the good social media platforms as well as the bad ones at Fun Fact Science. And what about yourself, Benjamin? Where can the good people find you?
On all the social media platforms as well. Look for Science Actually. And Facebook's the big one, but I'm on all the other ones as well. And you can see all the daily science facts and collective nouns and such. And if you want to watch this episode, just go to TikTok or YouTube. It will be there shortly.
Yes. And thank you, everyone, this is our sixth season, our 60th episode. So thank you to all of our listeners and watchers for joining us. And we will see you next season. On Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist.
Thank you.
Today's episode is brought to you by Science Socks. Whether you're into Mars rovers, the James Webb Space Telescope, or just showing off your love for all things nerdy, Science Socks has the right stuff to add that dash of galactic flair to your life. Go to sciencesocks.com/nerd, that's sciencesocks.com/nerd, to find the perfect wearables for scientists, engineers, nerds, and geeks. Science Socks. The only place in the galaxy for geeky socks and astronomical jewelry.
Brawler Nandies?
Yeah.
Got the delivery here for your next show?
Oh, great. What you got?
Well, let's see. I got one aardvark, one flamingo, 4 porcupines, 2 armadillos, 3 badgers.
Badgers? Badgers? We don't need no stinking badgers!